It's time to turn to the WUKY Sports page with your host, Keith Elkins, revealing conversations and stories you thought you knew from prominent Kentucky sports figures. Now, here once again is Keith Elkins.
Kevin Grevey is with us today. He was an All-American basketball player at Kentucky, a two-time SEC Player of the Year, scored 1,801 points for the Wildcats. That's in the days when there was no three-point basket and just 3 years of varsity competition. He went on to a 10-year career in the NBA and was a prominent player on the Washington Bullets championship team back in 1978. And he is, of course, a member of the UK Athletics Hall of Fame. Kevin, it's great to talk with you. Thanks for doing this today.
Oh, it was my pleasure, Keith. Glad to talk to you. Thank you.
Catch us up a little bit in the Wildcat Nation on what you're doing now, because you're still active and still putting in a pretty good work day, aren't you?
Yeah, I never thought I'd be a gentleman's farmer at this stage of my life, but that's how things evolved. I live in Great Falls, Virginia. I've never left the Washington, D.C. area. After I got drafted by the Bullets in 1975, I always thought I'd come back to Kentucky. I did after my rookie year and my second year. Rented a house there in Lexington with some friends, some old teammates and classmates at Kentucky, and worked on my game with the Kentucky players and a few of the NBA players that came back to the area. And I always thought I would, I adopted Kentucky like they adopted me, and I love Kentucky, and I said, this is going to be my home. And then my third year in the NBA, I was fortunate enough to be on that championship team. I met my wife, who is, we've been married now 42 years, and when you win a championship in the town you're playing in and met the love of my life, I was like, oh my God, yeah. I don't think I'm going back to Kentucky.
Yeah, that's pretty strong.
I stayed here in Virginia, and it reminds me of Kentucky. The further west you go from Washington, D.C., you start getting into horse country, Middleburg, Leesburg, beautiful, beautiful areas of Virginia. And I always felt like, man, this is like Kentucky in Virginia, you know, this is beautiful. Charlottesville, all that area. So I stayed in the area, and this is, I think, the fourth home I lived in. And when my wife and I bought this farm in Great Falls, and on the farm we have the house, that's where we live. Mm-hmm. And it's not like the big horse farms in Kentucky. It's 14-acre farm, big enough that for me it's plenty of work. We have 7 horses that stand on the property. It's a boarding facility. We have a dressage ring. We have a trainer. We have leases on the horses, and it's just become kind of a little small business that I've had on the side while I was I bought this property after my 10-year playing career, while I was broadcasting and scouting, and had a restaurant called Grevey's Restaurant and Sports Bar. So we've been here, I think my wife said, we're in our 30th year here on the farm.
Wow.
And now that I'm kind of semi-retired, Keith, it's nice to have this farm because it occupies a lot of my time. And I used to grudgingly work on the farm because I'd rather play golf, play tennis when I wasn't doing my other things. And now I kind of like, you know, golf and tennis is kind of taking a back seat to the horses. And, you know, you have to keep a safe environment, a healthy environment for the horses who all stand here. And I have a lot of bosses, all the owners of these horses and the leasers. They have certain expectations they want to meet when they come here and ride, or when they come to visit their horse. And we take a lot of pride in having a nice environment for them. So we kind of have our cake and eat it too. We have a home, an old home that we've refurbished, and the 14 acres that we keep up. So you can only imagine the kind of work, you know, people in Kentucky understand it.
Sure, yeah.
You know, painting fences and mending the fields and making sure, you know, the acid level's just right, and, you know, adding lime in the fall, and making sure that the barn is all operable and safe. And and then I got an old house that is always needing repair, so I spend a lot of time working on my home too. So it's all fun, really. I enjoy it.
Yeah, it says with the farm, the list is never, you've never checked off all the items on the to-do list. So there's always something. And
always something.
Yeah.
Always.
I was going to ask you about another phase of your post-playing days, of course, that occupied a lot of your time for a lot of years, was the scouting. And I wanted to ask you about what teams expect from a scout these days, because there's so many numbers crunched now and so many analytics, but a scout is still a valuable part of the organization. But how has that changed over the years, if it has, as far as what teams would expect from a scout?
Well, that's a great question. When I started scouting about 30 years ago, Jerry West, Mitch Kupchak brought me on to the Lakers organization, and that was in 1998. It was good timing, because right after I joined him, we won 3 world championships in a row with Kobe Bryant, Shaq, and Fisher and Horry, and people remember that team. And it was just a pleasure to get back into the basketball business and to do it with the Lakers, and to do it with a close friend and old teammate of mine from the Washington Bullets. And I remember the scouting department was, it was me, Jerry, Mitch, and Ronnie Lester. That was it. And the 4 of us, we didn't have an international scout because you didn't need one back then, because there wasn't a lot of international players yet coming into the NBA. They just started high school players, allowing them to come in. We had a coach that would follow the high school program. So I was kind of like a regional scout. I didn't have to leave my area too much. I'd let the teams, and I'm located in a great area where I had the Big Ten, the, you know, Penn State, Maryland, and ACC with Virginia and Virginia Tech, and didn't have the SEC, and no SEC teams were in this area, but then the Atlantic 10 and the CAA and the Patriot League and that kind of thing. So I was kind of a regional scout for about, and that's how Mitch sold it to me, because I was really busy at that time with my own restaurant, and I was broadcasting for CBS Westwood One. But that's how it kind of led in my broadcasting. Mitch would hear me on the radio and he said, "Kevin, what do you do? How do you prepare?" So I go to, I get in a day early, watch team practice. I meet with a sports information director. I try to meet with the coaches. I go to the, the visiting team practice, the home team practice. And then we put a pregame schedule together, me and my broadcast partner. And then on game day, I crunch, I just cram like I would in an exam, get all the stats. Back then they would fax them to you, and study the stats, and then away I would go. And he said, "Kevin, you do more preparation than our scouts do when they go to a game." And he said, "I think you'd be a good scout." And my kids were in high school at the time. I said, "Really? What does a scout do?" He said, "Pretty much what you said, and you've always been a high basketball IQ guy. You always, we talk basketball all the time. You know these players as well as some of us in the Laker office. I think you'd be good for us." So I talked to my wife about it. She said, "Well, what did you tell him?" I told him I'd think about it. She said, "Call him back up right now and tell him you'll take the job." And she said, "What are you tap dancing for?" I said, "Well, I'm so busy, Kevin. She said, I know you would love it, and you would be working with your best friend, Mitch. And I called him back and said, Mitch, I thought about it. And he said, but that was quick. I said, Sandy said I should do it. And he said, all right, I'm glad she's on board. And that was the beginning of my scouting. And that, I was a regional scout for about the first 5 or 6 years. And then here comes the international teams, our players coming. And they started really coming in like the floodgates opened. And Mitch said, you know, we're going to have to travel more. You're going to have to go to Treviso. You may have to go to Spain. You know, the we don't have an international scout. And I'm like, hey, Mitch, I'm game. You know, I'll be glad to do that. Can I bring my wife? Yeah, sure, Sandy can go. So we did that for about 4 or 5 years. Scouts who were domestic scouts would go overseas. And then Mitch realized, you know, it just wasn't cost effective. We needed to get an international scout. And they hired a guy who lived in Bologna, Italy, and became a very close friend of mine, Adam Felipe, and who played over in Italy. And now the international game, the NBA is expanding. And soon after that, we were embarking on a new analytics department in our office. We were the last to really do it. And there went the just the strict eye test to a numbers game on top of it. If anybody watched Moneyball or read the book, every coach in the NBA was going to their general managers and saying, hey, if we're going to field a roster, we better get on board with the analytics. And it's a huge part of scouting now. We opened up an analytics department. Mitch hired a guy from the MIT and another one from UC Santa Barbara, some talented, smart as hell young guys. And problem was they really weren't basketball people. They were more, you know, mathematical whizzes and they were putting all these formulas together and doing historical data. How, you know, the one thing that Mitch and the Lakers, and for that matter, every NBA team, you did not want to waste a first round pick on a miss. We have to get this right. And it's not an exact science, you know, and so we used it as a tool, and it did help us. And I was very confident that my voice, my eye test, was still weighted higher than the numbers. And we had those discussions, and they were candid discussions. We would do mock drafts, and the analytics would have, you know, the top 30 picks, and then we would do our mock draft. And it was like, oh, my God, what are these guys looking at? Mm-hmm. How did these numbers get to this player being a fifth pick or eighth pick? And so we would go through those numbers and we would find a way to kind of merge the two together. My eye, Mitch, Jerry, Ronnie Lester, and then we added a couple more scouts because we weren't regional scouts anymore. We became almost like global scouts. And I went from not traveling at all to traveling all the time. And I thought we did quite well. And so with the help of the analytics, I think it helps you limit the errors. Now, you know, with the NIL that has come into play over the last few, maybe 4 years, actually made it a little better for the NBA scouts because you're not just gambling now on a 19-year-old kid who's only played, who's coming right out of high school or maybe the one-and-done freshman. Because of the NIL, the players are making so much money in college that they're staying longer, which is good for the NBA and actually good for college. They're maturing and playing now, you know, with the COVID, they were getting 5, 6, 7 years, you know, of college basketball. But you get a chance to see that player play a lot more and can grade them and see their improvement or their regression. And you're not gambling as much as you were. But, of course, the NIL is also on the flip side. There's a lot of negatives with the money and how it's distributed and how players are hopping from one team to another every year. And I remember, you know, how the conference realignments, players moving around. We would go training camp and start talking about rosters. I said, wait a second. That guy doesn't play for West Virginia. Oh, yeah, he transferred. Well, wait a second. West Virginia, isn't that in the, you know, the ACC? No, they're in the Big 12 now. I was like, oh, my God. Every summer, you know, things would change so drastically. So you had to stay on your toes. But I loved it. It was a great job. And I finished with the Hornets last year. After the Lakers and the Buss family had some disputes, Mitch took over the Charlotte Hornets for Michael Jordan and ran the basketball office, and I worked the last 6 years with Charlotte. So I am retired. I'm just doing some little work with the Wizards here locally here in Washington and working my farm. But it's been a heck of a journey, almost 50 years of NBA from player out broadcasting. It was I look back on it and I'm like, holy cow, where did the time go? You know?
Yeah, that's a question a lot of us ask at this stage of life, isn't it? Where did the time go?
Now, Keith, it catches up with you.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the beginning of that journey and your days as a player. You grew up in a sports-oriented family and, of course, established yourself as eventually the best player in Ohio. So a lot of attention, a lot of paper mail in those days, a lot of letters and things like that. But tell me, if you can, about the recruitment. Coach Rupp was nearing the end of his time at Kentucky, although that wasn't certain exactly when he would step aside. But tell me about that situation and how the Wildcats finally won the battle.
Well, I'll be candid with you. Kentucky was like the last school to recruit me. I remember my mother collecting all the letters from all the inquiries from schools around the country, and I must have had a couple hundred, visited probably 20, 30 schools my junior and part of my senior year, and still no Kentucky. And I didn't even get a letter from Kentucky. And I remember talking to my dad, who played at Xavier, and my parents very involved with my recruiting process. And Southern Ohio is where I'm from, in Hamilton, even though I had grandparents from Crab Orchard, Kentucky, and we would visit and go to Kentucky. And my dad said, you know, if you really get good at this game, you know, you might be able to accomplish what I did. And I played at Xavier. You can go to Miami or Cincinnati or Ohio State or Dayton. But if you're really good, maybe Kentucky will recruit you. So my dad was already, you know, feeding me that when I was a youngster, you know, playing and hoping to, you know, make my high school team. But I had dreams of playing college, but I never looked beyond that. And so my senior year, I had a kind of a coming out for myself personally. I had a great high school coach who felt that I was good enough to play at some of those Southern Ohio schools. And then I got player of the year in Ohio. And on my team was my close friend Jim Duff, who was also, a lifelong friend. We knew one another. We grew up going to camps and playing basketball together, among other things. And Jim's dad, Cecil Duff, had a farm in Cynthiana, Kentucky. And Jim kept saying, I wonder why Kentucky's not recruiting you, Kevin. And I'm like, I don't know, but Kansas is recruiting me, Indiana, UCLA. I don't know what's wrong with Kentucky. And Keith, I don't know. I never got the answer to that question, but one day I go to practice kind of the end of my senior year, and Jim Duff says, "Kevin, Dad talked to Joe B. Hall. He went right to the basketball office and said, hey, why are you all late to the party? We've got this kid that's at Hamilton, and he just got named Ohio Player of the Year. Why, you know, you recruited Mike Pratt. He's from Ohio. All these Ohio players. Why? What is it with Kentucky?" He said, "You know, Cecil, we're making a point to go up and see Kevin play his last regular season game." And he said, "Well, I'm really glad to hear that." And so they did come, and all these blue coats come to my high school gym, and I was so excited that Kentucky was actually going to be in my gym and watch me play. And I played horrible. I had the worst game. I've never been nervous on a basketball court in my life, but I was that game. And I remember coming off at halftime, my dad's like, I'm walking through the tunnel to get to the locker room. He's, "Kevin, what's wrong?" I said, "I don't know, Dad. I don't know. Leave me alone. Dad, I don't know what's wrong." He said, "Relax, relax. Play your game." And I went in, and I just thought to myself, I blew it. I had 8 points. I missed every shot I took, you know, and I'm like, oh, my God, what happened? And I go up in the second half of my high school game. It was our Hamilton-Garfield. It was a rival game. And I looked up there, and a lot of those blue coats were gone. They were gone. And I, now I'm not just deer in the headlights, you know, kind of like, what's wrong? I was now angry. And I took it out on Garfield. I had 32 points in the second half. Ended up with 40. And the game ended, and all the coaches were gone. Everybody left. And I said, "Dad, I blew it." He said, "No, you didn't." He said, "They'll hear about it. They understand. They just wanted to acknowledge you that they were at the gym." And I remember they didn't have cell phones back then. I got a late night call, and it was Joe B. Hall. He said, "I heard what you did in the second half." He said, "We had to get back to Lexington. Kevin, that game doesn't matter. We saw what your skill level is. We want you. We're going to offer you a scholarship. And as soon as your state tournament's over with, we want you to take official visit." And I was like ecstatic. I couldn't believe it. I went from the most disappointed to the happiest I could be that Kentucky, you know, in spite of that ugly first half, they were going to still give me a scholarship. And I was an easy sell after that, you know, because that's where I really wanted to go all along. It's just they were late coming out to see me. And thank goodness they did, because it's a gift that keeps on giving, Keith, having played at Kentucky with all those great players and all that history and the great coaches that I was able to play under. You know, even though I didn't get to play under Coach Rupp my freshman year, I practiced with the varsity, and I was with those guys and guarding the veterans, you know, Tom Parker, and really getting a great education. You know, that freshman year was something, but it all worked out so well. But you never know, you know, you dream, you hope, you pray that you belong and that you can make this. But I know I was obsessed. I was not, I wanted to be the best player I could possibly be. And that meant to be in the best shape, to study the game. And I was getting a good education of basketball with my dad, but sitting with the coaches and watching video and tape. Well, it was film back then. Mm-hmm. I just kept learning and then playing with those other really great players that came in with me. And Bob Guyette, who, you know, there were 4 players of the year, Bob from Illinois, Mike Flynn from Indiana, and Jimmy Dan Connor from Kentucky, along with Jerry Hale, G.J. Smith, and Steve Lottmuller. So, you know, the 8 of us were, the freshman team. And then, my good friend Jim Duff, whose dad had a lot to do with me going to Kentucky, he walked on, and he was on the team. And Coach Hall, you know, he's like, I'm so glad you brought me. What are you talking about, Grevy? I went to Hamilton Taft High School to sign Jim Duff, not you. You know, and Jim, you know, has become quite a story himself. You know, he worked on the Supreme Court, and Jim should have been a Rhodes Scholar. He's like the smartest guy I ever knew, and it's good, you know, when you're growing up, be around smart people.
Right.
You know, keep you out of trouble. And Jim, you know, was the interim dean of the law school this past year, and they offered him the job, but he, like me, we're both 73. He decided that it was too late for him to take the dean. And but my wife and I, we love going back to Kentucky. My best friends are still my freshman team. Those guys that I mentioned, I came in together. And when you play at a school like Kentucky, it's a lot bigger than, especially after scouting and going across the country. And there are only a handful of schools that have the kind of history that Kentucky has. You know, obviously UCLA and Indiana and Duke and North Carolina, Kansas. I'm sure I'm missing a couple, but there's a real responsibility when you play and put on a uniform at a school like that. And Coach Hall, Coach Rupp, and the assistant coaches always remind us of what a special place we were at. And I remember them bringing Dan Issel, Cotton Nash, and Louis Dampier, just, you know, all the old, you know, Cliff Hagan, and they would come watch practice. We would sit in a circle. They would talk to us for 15-20 minutes about the responsibility. The players before you, you're in a special place now. Live in the now, be the best team you can be, and then when you leave, like us, you'll be alumni, you'll be proud of the effort that you put in. And everything that you accomplish around the way will mean something to you later in life. And I'd hear those remarks, and you'd walk the halls of Memorial Coliseum, see all the All-Americans. I knew every All-American. I knew every player, I think, that ever wore a uniform at Kentucky. That history was drummed into us. And to understand the history helps you with the present and the effort that you're going to put forth. You know, most, when you go to a D1 school, you know, you're playing for yourself. You're a little selfish. You're playing for your family. You're playing for your teammates and the coach. When I went to Kentucky, I was playing for Big Blue Nation, and it wasn't called that then. But I mean, I knew that I have to be on my best behavior, make it work. When you're a teenager, hell yeah, you're going to go out and have a beer. You're going to do some stupid things you shouldn't do. But we kept it to a minimum, and we were always brought back down to what we're here for. And that was one of Coach Hall's biggest gifts, because he played at Kentucky. Mm-hmm. He knew the history. He knew how important it was not to fail, not, you know, to get a failing grade or to do something that could embarrass you and the school. I remember Harry Lancaster. He was, you know, the athletic director, was a coach under Coach Rupp. I did something on the court in a game at the UKIT. I was getting some bad calls, and I mouthed something I shouldn't have mouthed, you know, and to the referee, and I got a technical foul. And Harry read my lips, and he grabbed me after that game, threw me against a locker. I know what you said to the ref. I read your lips. And so did about 11,000 other Kentucky fans. And you're better than that. If I ever see you behave like that again, I'm going to tell Coach Hall he's going to have to remove you. I'm like, whoa. I'm like, yeah. I'm all right, Harry, I'm sorry. I'll never do it again. He said, you bet your ass you'll never do that again. And that's the kind of, you know, discipline that we were under. But we needed that. And Kentucky deserves that. And we were not going to embarrass ourselves. And, yeah, I made a mistake. I owned up to it. But I look back and, man, some of the things that we were able to do was very special. And, you know, we won two SEC championships. We got to the NCAA championship. The worst loss, the toughest loss I ever had was to UCLA in 1975 when we lost that game. Because we came in the number one freshman team in the country, and we kept adding pieces. And when you bring on, when you're a senior class, and we bring in Rick Roby and Mike Phillips and Jack Givens and James Lee to go with our group, that was one hell of a team. And we should have won, but we didn't. And that day, that night, we probably didn't deserve it, even though we played 12 guys and they played six. They had no bench. It was John Wooden's last game. They had all the momentum from him announcing his retirement. We also had a deflated, we thought Louisville was going to beat UCLA. We beat Syracuse in the two semifinal matchups, and we stayed around rooting for Louisville to beat UCLA because, man, we wanted an all-Kentucky final. We knew we could beat Louisville. We wanted those guys, and we got UCLA. Well, careful for what you wish for, you right. know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was a tough one, and it's one that still burns. Talking about it hurts.
Yeah,
but I always felt like, you know, you can't rewrite history. You learn what doesn't kill you. You can learn from it. And I swear it helped me my third year in the NBA to win an NBA World Championship because I never wanted that feeling ever again. When we got to a Game 7 in Seattle, when everything was against us, everybody thought Seattle was going to beat us in the Game 7. We won. And it was all worth it. Even though that loss to UCLA hurt so bad, I was able to finally say I'm a champion, and I did it in the NBA.
It's amazing. Those who are involved in sports, especially those who reach the top level, it's the team wins for almost everybody that mean the most, and sometimes the team losses that hurt the most if you have one like that in your past. And I know the
yeah.
UCLA loss has stayed with those players for a long, long time. Unfortunately, you were able to experience the championship at the NBA level. Let me go back for just a second to that freshman season at UK because, as you mentioned, it was a freshman team. Freshmen were not eligible that year. They were the next year, but that was the final year that freshmen were not eligible for varsity play, so they had freshman teams, and your team went undefeated with the group that you named earlier. The crowd would show up early. The freshman games were played before the varsity games, and the crowd would fill up the Coliseum early, I know, because I was part of that crowd. We wanted to get there early and as students and see the freshman game. From your perspective, what was it like being on that team, getting all that attention in your first year at a time when you couldn't even play for the varsity?
It was amazing. We felt like rock stars, you know, when you're your freshman year. The practices were brutal. Coach Hall was, you know, had the running program, the weightlifting program leading up to the October 15th, the beginning of practice. Every day in practice was competitive as all get out. I mean, we were freshmen working together, but we were playing against the varsity in open gyms with Jim Andrews, Tom Payne, Tom Parker, God, they were good, and they were bigger, stronger, more mature, but we were a little younger, a little better shape, and I'm real hungry. And those veterans weren't going to just roll down and die for a bunch of freshmen just because they're the number one freshman team in the country. And we didn't get to play on the varsity, but we practiced against them. And Coach Rupp, that, you know, he was salivating. He knew we were all quite a good bunch of guys, and he could take us for another 2 or 3, 4 years if he could stay on. And most of us, I know I was promised that Coach Rupp would be gone and I'd be playing for Joe B. Hall my varsity season, my sophomore year. And that's the way I was understood. And I think my teammates had that same promise. But, you know, we all got to know Coach Rupp working against him, and we all started liking him. You know, it was like, you know, we had, you know, there was this huge age gap. He was 65, and we were, you know, maybe 17, 18 years old, 19 years old, the oldest, and coming there to Kentucky. And it was kind of a quagmire. I was like, Dad, you know, Coach Rupp is really a pretty amazing guy. He's really, I said, well, yes, he is, but you're not going to play for him, right? And I said, I don't know. He's asking to stay on. And he said, listen, do not get involved in that politically. And I know Coach Rupp wanted all of us freshmen to speak out on his behalf. And Coach Hall, you know, didn't want that to happen. He wanted to coach that team. The president of the university, I think, was put in a pickle, you know. And so it was a weird time to be at Kentucky, but I was just going to let it play out however it did. If Coach Rupp stayed, great. If Coach Hall took over the team, great. I wasn't going to be, you know, involved in that decision. I was just going to – I knew I was going to play 4 years in Kentucky. I didn't want to burn any bridges. I just wanted to have the best success I could have. And I remember where that summer after my freshman year, there was the Rupp Issell Pratt basketball camp. And Dan Issel and Mike Pratt, you know, were course allies to Coach Rupp. And they were expounding on how great it would be if Coach Rupp stayed on to coach you guys. And I worked at camp, and at the end of the camp, you go up and you get payment for your week. It was a couple hundred dollars, and you'd have to go up to Coach Rupp's room. And maybe he'd have a sip of bourbon with him, and, you know, he would give you an envelope of money. And I was so afraid to be in that room by myself with Coach Rupp. I just said, I don't want the $200. I'm not going to do it. And finally, after 4 weeks of camp, he knew I was dodging him. And he said, Kevin, here's an envelope. You worked for this. This is yours. Here's a couple other envelopes for your girlfriend. Take her out to dinner, and you tell her, Coach, this is from Coach Rupp. And I want you to also think the rest of the summer now how it would be playing for me. I'm not going to go easy. I think I'm going to stay. And I said, well, if that happens, that'd be great, Coach. It'd be an honor to play for you. And that's the last conversation I ever had with Coach Rupp. And, of course, he was pretty much pushed out.
Yeah.
Kind of hard to believe that would happen in this day of time. But his health was declining, and Coach Hall was eager to coach. And it was a blessing to play for Coach Hall. I mean, he was fabulous. He was great. Made me a better player. I loved him. I really did. But who knows what it would have been like if Coach Rupp had stayed.
Yeah, but, that is a big,
Yeah, that's a big what if. And
You were there around during that time.
Yeah, and there were stories nearly every day in the papers about what was happening, which way it was going to go. Mm-hmm. And of course, a huge story when he finally, they reached an agreement anyway, that he would retire. Yeah. And then, of course, he maintained an office there in the Coliseum, was actually around a little while, even had a television show for a little while after Joe Hall became the head coach. And let me ask you if you would about the transition to Coach Hall there, because your first varsity season was Joe Hall's first season as the head coach at UK, and as you said, he understood the tradition, and of course he probably put a lot of extra pressure on himself during that time. But did you sense that from him, that there was a lot of pressure on him, or was he able to coach as he would normally coach and get the most out of his team that way?
You know, the one thing, you know, his practice, you know, we maintained a lot of the same offense that Coach Rupp ran at Kentucky, 6-8-10. We had his own offense that we would run. And so we were doing a lot of the things that Coach Rupp did offensively. The one thing Coach Hall really changed was the fast break. He felt like we weren't, that Coach Rupp didn't, towards the end, run and get the open offense quick enough. And he brought in, I remember, some of the Celtics, and we imitated a lot of the Celtic fast break. Coach Rupp talked to Red Auerbach. Red Auerbach came to talk to us, you know, and told him Coach Hall is going to implement the fast break, and this is how we do it. We fill the lanes, get the ball in the middle. You know, it was typical fast break. But what made the Celtic offense was the trailing center, which would have been Bob Guyette or later on Rick Roby or Mike Phillips, would go to the top of the key. And if you didn't get your early offense, then you threw that ball to the top of the key, and then there would be pin downs, and you'd go right into an automatic fast break offense. It wasn't a sit down 6-8-10. We did that after a timeout or a dead ball. We would run our half court offense. But I would say 50-60% of our offense was all fast break offense. And then Coach Hall implemented the 1-3-1 zone defense. And that became really a brand of his. And boy, we got good at that. And your two most athletic positions on that 1-3-1 is the guard on top and then the guard on the baseline. And then the other three would just make a line, you know, from end to end. And so Jimmy Dam would run the baseline and Mike Flynn would be on the point. And they were both big guards and they were fast and they were long. And we could get traps out of. We created so much offense in that 1-3-1 defense. Coach Rupp didn't do any of those things. And so that was the biggest change. And then the pressure coach you alluded to, Coach Hall, was under. I don't know how he handled it the way he did. I've talked to him later in life, you know, and we talked about it. And he admitted that there was pressure, of course, but then, you know, Coach Rupp would go on his TV show or his radio show, or he'd be in the hallway in his office, come out, and he would, you know, try to be gentle, but it was, you know, I wouldn't have done it that way. I don't know why Joe, you know, froze the ball. He froze it too early, and he let the other team back in the game, and you know, he would say stuff, and of course, you know, Coach Hall would hear that and the fans would hear it, and it would, Coach Rupp was criticizing Joe B for the way he coached the team in that game or how he's approaching things. And that was tough on Coach Hall, but he handled it well. He never, you know, let us know that he was hearing these things. It just made him steely, tougher. Practices were longer, harder. And I don't really think Coach Hall was able to really unburden himself following a legend until after we won the SEC championship. When we beat Tennessee, and of course, only one team went to the tournament, and that was the SEC champions. And our sophomore year, we had to beat Tennessee to garner the SEC bid. And we did it in one tough, hard game. We won, you know, I think by 6 or 7 points. We won the game, but it was a national TV game. And I remember when we won, we all ran to the bench. We put Coach Hall on his, on our shoulders, and we took him to his interview at half court. And I've never seen us happier than we were after we knew we were SEC champions. We did it with Coach Hall, and now we're going to the NCAA tournament. And we got to the regional finals, lost to Indiana, or we would have been in our first Final Four. But it was a, you know, we were just so happy for Coach Hall. And after that point, I think he knew it was his team. He started, you know, recruiting the kind of players that could play the 1-3-1, that could play racehorse basketball, who were fast, could make good decisions in the open court, weren't a bunch of plotters. And, you know, we, I don't know how many years coached there, 10, 12 years, but, you know, it's almost Hall of Fame material. It's sad that he's not in the Basketball Hall of Fame, because he won, you know, in 78, and he went to 4 or 5 Final Fours. He had a great career, and he was Kentucky through and through. He loved Kentucky, and he passed that on down to everybody that wore that uniform.
Kevin, I had just a couple of more things to ask you about. Have you got just a little bit more time?
Yes.
Okay, good. I was going to ask you to let's skip ahead to your senior year now. You're coming off a junior year in which the team went 13-13. And, of course, Coach Hall took a lot of heat for that. You had a lot of talent but needed some big people. And then he went out and had a great recruiting class. And you got the big people plus some other talented players as well. And then that senior year, you won the first couple of games but then had the decisive loss at Indiana that served as an inspiration really for the rest of the season. What was your perspective on that game, both as it transpired and then after it was over? How did you build from it?
Well, we were, you know, highly ranked going into our senior year. We were a top five team. And we had taken a trip to Australia after that 13-13 year, my junior year. We had injuries. We were out of position. Everything could go wrong, went wrong. And then we had this great recruiting class, as you mentioned. And then we took the trip to Australia, and we all came together, and we like, hey, we're going to end on a good note. We all really committed to one another and be the best team we could be. And those freshmen were so good. I mean, they came in ready to go like we did when we were freshmen. It was one of the best recruiting classes Kentucky ever had. Our class, the Super Kittens, and then that class with Roby Phillips, Givens, Lee. Yeah, they were great. And we knew we were good. And we practiced like we were going to have one goal, and that was to be champions. And when we got knocked down in Bloomington, Indiana, the way we got beaten, the way Bobby Knight treated Coach Hall there at courtside when he slapped him in the back of the head when the game was still going on and it was garbage time and he was running the score up, and you know, it left us a bad taste. We left there wounded but not beaten down. And Coach Hall, you know, he was a master at motivating, and he's like, we're not going to forget this. You all feel pain. I feel pain. We're driving back to Lexington. Tomorrow morning, we're going to have practice, we're going to watch film of this game. I know it's ugly, but we're going to have to get better. And I saw areas that we can improve. We're not as bad as we were in this game tonight in Bloomington, but we're not as good as we thought we were going into the game. So we're going to right the ship, and we got to play North Carolina in 2 days. And that will determine, are we the team that we think we are, or are we going to take a step back? And we practiced, we prepared, we corrected some of the things we did against Indiana. One of them was we weren't fighting over screens. Well, they all, you know, and Indiana, Bobby Knight, the moving screens were their mode of operandi. And it's so hard as a defender to get through or under or over a moving screen. And it's illegal, but they were allowed to do it. And so we got better at, you know, playing defense. And that North Carolina game at Freedom Hall, and I have to shout out to my teammate, Jimmy Dan Connor. He had one of the best games I ever had a teammate have. I don't know what he ended up with. He may have had 38, 36 points.
Something in there, yes. Yeah,
he was unbelievable. But he was our captain. He was our tough guy. And he felt the pain like we all did, and we were going to come back. And you have to do it collectively. Not, you know, I can't have an out-of-body game and carry the team over North Carolina. We all had to do it together. And we did. And Jimmy Dan, the bucket looked like a bathtub to him. And he just couldn't miss. Our big guys were controlling the boards. And North Carolina was a hell of a team, man. They were really good. You know, with Bobby Jones and Mitch Kupchak, George Karl, they were good. They were ranked higher than us after our loss to Indiana. But That was the watershed moment for us in that season. The loss to Indiana and the comeback bounce back game against the Tar Heels of North Carolina. And once we did that, we flushed that bad game away. But we also said, we're going to win a championship. It's going to have to go through Indiana. We will see them again. And we'll be a better team after this gauntlet, the SEC, that we have to go through. And if we come out of the SEC the way I think we can, we'll be we'll meet Indiana again, and we will beat them. And he started talking about that in friggin' November. Yeah. December. And if we, you know, thought we were really good, remember what our goals are. Our goal is to win an SEC championship. Our goal is not just to win this game tonight. And our goal is to win an NCAA championship, and we're going to go through Indiana. And back then, we would watch Indiana on TV, because we could get their feeds, we could get some of their games, and we'd watch UCLA, you know, the Bruins. We watched teams that we thought we would have to beat to win a championship. Louisville, right down the road. I mean, we all knew Alan Murphy and Junior Bridgman and Wesley Cox and Bunton and all those guys. We knew every one of those guys. We'd see them in the summers. We'd work out with them, and we saw how well Denny Crum was getting Louisville to go. We thought, you know, we may have to play them. Back then, we didn't schedule any other schools in the state of Kentucky. Coach Rupp wouldn't do it, and so we never played Louisville or Western Kentucky or any of the other schools. But so we were prepared mentally of who we were going to be playing and who and how we were going to have to win, and more than likely who it would be. Coach Hall was great at that.
Well, it actually did come down to meeting Indiana again in Dayton, not far from your hometown, and that's the NCAA Regional Final, a game that UK fans who were around at that time still talk about. 92-90 was the final. What's the greatest memory you have from that game?
Well, at that time, it was the greatest win I ever had, and the only win that ever supplanted that 92-90 win against Indiana and Dayton in the regional finals was the world championship I had in 1978 in Seattle. So we accomplished our goals, and maybe, just maybe, we expended too much of our energy against Indiana. We felt like we climbed the mountaintop, you know, but that next week we had to go to the Final Four, and we had to play Syracuse, and then we had to play UCLA in the championship. And I think we had another couple hundred feet to climb Mount Everest. We weren't quite at the top. It felt like we were when we beat Indiana. It was a great win. Everybody played so well, and our game plan was perfect. And I talked about those moving screens. Well, we didn't go over, we didn't go under, we went through. And to go through a screen means you have to put your shoulder in, and you got to knock that guy down, or you got to move him. And those moving screens weren't moving as much as that game went on. And we were able to get out to their shooters and their screens and fight through them better. And Kent Benson, he had this great game. But our big guys, when you look at it, Bob Guyette, Rick Roby, Mike Phillips, they matched his 32 points collectively, the three of them did. So they offset that great game that Kent Benson had. They were a senior-laden team like we were, and things just fell right for us, but we earned it. You know, there was no apologies by Indiana. Bobby Knight said after the game, Kentucky was terrific. And then a year later, he said, they won the NCAA championship the next year. And he said that his 75 team might have been better than the team that won the championship. He had a great team. They were undefeated, and we dethroned them in Dayton. Couldn't have done it without Coach Hall, his motivation, his mind games that he was playing with us. He was mapping out how this game would go before the game. You know, we would sit and we would do a chalkboard, and it would have all the plays that we're going to run against them and their plays and key individual matchups. He had none of that on the board. All he had on the board was, he wrote down, I'll probably get this wrong, but he wrote down nets, then he wrote down police, then he wrote down bridge, and then he wrote down Coliseum. And then we're like, what is this? And, the first thing he wrote down was pancake. Pancake was knocking down that moving screen. Nets where we're going to cut down the nets. It's going to be the greatest police escort, and we're going to be going under these bridges full of Kentucky fans. And when we get to the Coliseum, we're going to have the craziest, wildest pep rally Kentucky has ever seen. He was telling us how the game was going to go, how we were going to win, what it was going to feel like, and the celebration we were going to have after. We were already prepared. We knew what we were going to have to do. Now it was, he was mapping out the emotions that we were going to feel. And man, when we busted through that locker room door to take the Dayton Fieldhouse floor, we just knew we were going to do it. And that's part of winning. you know, you're not going to win a game if you don't think you can win. And he took all the doubt out from that ugly game we had in early December when we played Indiana and Bloomington. And revenge is a great thing, you know, we got it.
Yeah.
And, but I have to also say with an asterisk that maybe there was too much celebration. Maybe there was too much euphoria. We still didn't win a championship yet, you know.
Well, yeah.
And that could have come back and haunted us a little bit.
Yeah, you mentioned the loss to UCLA and how that lasts. But you did, as a third-year NBA player, you did get an NBA championship with the Washington Bullets and players like Wes Unseld and Elvin Hayes on the team. And here you are, a third-year player, and you're beginning to work your way into the league. But tell me about how that season developed and what made that team such a great championship team.
We had a great general manager and owner who had the vision and built a roster to win a championship. They weren't just trying to be good. They were trying to win it all. And there was a culture there that felt like Kentucky a little bit. We had great leadership in Wes and Elvin. We had a coach in Dick Motta who had been through all the wars in Chicago. He came close, but now he was trying to get these Washington Bullets to the finish line. And I was a young player drafted to come in and to fill a shooting guard role that Phil Chenier had, but Phil got injured that third year in training camp. So I became the shooting guard. And then the point guard was kind of done by committee, Larry Wright, Kevin Porter, and then Tommy Henderson ended up solidifying that point guard spot. So we had a veteran team integrated with some young players like myself, Greg Ballard and Mitch Kupchak. And the one player I haven't mentioned was Bobby Dandridge, who was a small forward. And if you were going to beat the 76ers, somebody had to guard Dr. J. Mm-hmm. Somebody had to offset Dr. J's points. If you're going to beat San Antonio Spurs, you got George Gervin. Somebody's got to defend the leading scorer in the NBA and George Gervin. And we had that guy in Bobby Dandridge. Bobby became a Hall of Fame player. That front line with the Washington Bullets, Wes, Elvin, and Bobby, those all three of them are in the Basketball Hall of Fame. And then that team, that 1978 team, is in the Hall of Fame. But it's strange, Keith, there was this commitment to win a championship, but during the regular season, it's a gauntlet, 82 games, we had one injury after another, but Dick Motta and Bob Ferry and the owners, like, you know what? Let's don't worry about our seeding and where we fit in the conference going into the playoffs. Let's get healthy. So if we have to lose 15 of our last 20 games, we're not going to go in on a high, riding a wave, but we will protect ourselves and be healthy. And because we had older veterans like Wes, who's getting his knees drained, and Elvin Hayes, who had a bad back, and Mitch Kupchak, who had a torn rotator cuff in his shoulder, they all took medical absence to get ready for the playoffs. Now, I was a young player. I'm playing every minute, every game. Didn't matter to me. I felt strong. But it was those veterans that they got well. And then it was our leadership in Wes Unseld. And he's like, you know, there's nothing more important to me right now, these next 2 months, than winning a championship. You know, I start with God, family, and basketball. And he said, and that's the order in which I march my life. But these next 3 months I'm going to invert that. And it's going to be basketball, family, and then God. And we're going to give thanks for every step we take to win a championship. So now you are my basketball family. And if one of you guys, I find out, has the Georgetown flu, that's in other words, going out drinking, or if you don't commit 100%, and when we leave Bowie State College practice and we go to the Capitol Center, and when we're on our team bus or when we're on our flight, we're all going to be as one, and we're going to talk about how we can win this championship. And I'm like, wow, the big fella really means it. You know?
Yeah.
I never had a captain talk like this. Dick Mott is in the corner. He didn't have to say a word. I mean, when a player speaks like that. And Wes said, you all are younger. You guys might have another chance. This is my last chance. This is my last dance. And I want to win a championship. And I have not won a championship. We've come close. I've had player of the year, I had rookie of the year, but I won a championship. And I will do any means to get it. And I want the same commitment from you all. And he went right down, do I have your commitment? Do I have yours? Do I have yours? Do I have yours? And that's the leadership we had on that team. We don't win a championship if we don't have Wes Unseld setting that bar the high every single day we were together. And we had some big, tough things to overcome. We had to beat 76ers, who the year before lost to the Portland Trailblazers in a championship. And their whole theme that year was, we owe you one, Philly. And we had to beat that great team that Philly was, with Daryl Dawkins and Bobby Jones, George McGinnis, Doug Collins, Lloyd B. Free, Dr. J, Andrew Toney. I mean, they were good. They were the best team in the Eastern Conference. We beat them without a home court advantage. We had to beat San Antonio. We to this day, Keith, we have the worst regular season record for a team that won a championship. We were 42-38. We barely had a winning record. But I told you why. We rested a lot of guys to get healthy. And then when we started the playoffs, we beat Atlanta, then we beat Philly, then we beat San Antonio, then we beat the Sonics. Each one of those series, we did not have the home court advantage on purpose. They decided the home court advantage wasn't as important as being healthy. And I remember when I was working with the Lakers, I asked Phil Jackson that question. Phil, if you had a chance to have the best record in the Eastern or on the Western Conference at the time with the Lakers, have home court advantage in every 7-game series, would that be more important than resting the last couple months of the season, getting healthy and being more healthy? I mean, because you were going to expend yourself to get the best record. He said, I will take health over best record any day. I said, really? I said, do you know, that's how Dick Mott and Bob Ferry and Abe Pullen are on with the Bullets. I told him what I'm telling you here on this podcast. And he said, Kevin, that was such forward thinking, that because you had Wes and Elvin, you had some elder statesmen, you had to be rested to go through those tough playoff series. That was smart. And he said, I'm doing that right now with Shaq. You know, he's the biggest force in the NBA. If I told Shaq and I played him 38, 40 minutes every game, yeah, we would probably win 70 games. But I'd rather us win 55, 60 games and not show all your cards to the whole league and be healthy. And I'm like, well, that's why you're Phil Jackson. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why you're one of the greats. Mm-hmm. You know how many first game, you know, when you start an NBA series, first game, how many first games did he lose as a coach with Chicago or the Lakers? Not a one. He was like 33-0. He won that first game of every series. I'm like, whoa, what a record.
Yeah.
You know, Phil's great. And it was good to be around later in my life, to be around the greats, you know, because you think you know everything in basketball, you never stop learning. And while I was scouting and being around the Bill Burkas and Michael Jordans and Magic Johnson and all those guys, you know, you're sitting, you're playing cards, you're talking basketball, you're on the plane having a beer, and it was just wonderful to be a part of that, and it was really a gift. And you know, now I'm taking manure out of stalls, but you know, I sure had a good run and a good time, and I loved every minute of it.
Well, you're doing that by choice, at least, so that's
yes,
good. Yeah,
I am.
Well, Kevin, it's been great to get this look at basketball from you, and of course to celebrate those playing days at UK. You had such a great career and remembered so fondly by many, many UK fans of that generation and the ones before, and it's just been a pleasure to talk about that with you, and I appreciate you joining us today.
Oh, I love talking about basketball, especially to Kentucky fans and a Kentuckian like yourself, Keith, anytime.
You've been listening to the WUKY Sports Page with your host, Keith Elkins, an exclusive podcast from 91.3 WUKY, produced at the WUKY studios by Alan Lytle. Our theme music is Peanut Butter and Jam by Illogical Bit, available at soundcloud.com/illogicalbit. Subscribe to the Sports Page through iTunes, Google Play, or at our website, wuky.org.